upon other perfections to come.
And one perfection.
Okay, thank you very much. I thought we should carry on, in a sense, from Matthew's presentation last time. We're trying to make this a bit of a dialogue, and Matthew very expertly talked about icon veneration in terms of praxis, and we got a very nice explanation of what praxis means quite precisely. And one feature of it that I recall is that it has at least a connotation of aggression. Am I correct? There's a sense of in any case, effort is certainly emphasized. So, in the, again, we're in a sense limiting the talk of Morti Seda to a particular tradition to a large extent, not entirely, but the Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition. One can find certainly family resemblances and connections to other Vaishnava traditions. One can also find connections, family resemblances to non-Vaishnava, so-called Hindu traditions. One of the terms that will come up in probably most of these traditions is the word sadhana. And I sort of very carefully titled this sadhana that opens one to perfection. I didn't want to say that leads to perfection or that one makes and thereby gets perfection. In other words, it's not that one necessarily leads to the other, because there is the factor of grace, which I think would be another theme which would invite dialogue, discussion across traditions that we know are in many respects radically different. But that will be a bit of our sort of central theme. Three sort of subtopics we can open that out to. First of all, a tiny touch of history and legend. just considering the time factor and enough to get us going to perhaps the more substantial topic of praxis. And this second point, closer look at praxis, means we're also getting back to some things we touched on the last time. And if all works well with our technology, we'll have a bit of a video, not exactly a clip, but something of the festivities that go on in one of the temples that we're looking at in Vrindavan. Essentially, all I want to say from the side of history and legend is that the tradition would see three types of images in terms of how they come about. Actually, they will see more than that, but this is enough to keep us busy. Human-made, celestial-made, we talked a bit about celestials the last time, and what's called svayam-vyakta, which means self manifest. In other words, the deity, the person, the divinity, him, or mainly him, but also herself, appears themselves. And so I will relate those, I'll elaborate on those a bit in a moment. The theme behind all of these would be that there is a desire by humans to connect with the Lord, with divinity, and that desire is then reciprocated by the Lord. And one way that the Lord shows his reciprocation is to either appear through some agency or to appear himself. That would be the essential idea. So, an example of a human-made deity, or in this case, pair of deities. These are not found in India. This picture is from Hungary, actually. One of the, or the main Krishna temple in Hungary at present. Radha Shyamasundara, they're known as. Made of marble, produced probably in Jaipur, in northwestern India, by marble sculptors who produce such images for a wide clientele. Up on the right is an image of Jagannath, and I showed another image of him together with his sister and brother previously, the last time, from a different temple. The, so to say, original or main Jagannath deity is in western India, Puri. And you can see during the annual procession festival, when they bring the image of Jagannath out from the temple, preparing to bring him into one of the three carts that will then carry him to a place 2 miles away and back over a period of a week. The point I wanted to make here is there's an elaborate story about how this image came about. In this case, it was a king of ancient times who desired to have the darshan, to see this form of the Lord so strongly, and yet so many obstacles came in his way until messages would come to him, divine messages from the sky, telling him that in due course his desire would be fulfilled if he would follow certain procedures. And when it came time for the image, in this case a wooden image, to be carved, there was a condition put upon his being allowed to see this image, and that was that he's not allowed to observe the production of the deity until it is completed. And it was understood that the person or person's work, actually one person doing the carving, was actually a celestial. His impatience, however, overcame him, such that he, being a sort of strong-minded kingly type, burst into the room where the construction was going on, the carving was going on, only to find that the carver was now gone. As had been warned, if he would interrupt the work would stop. The carver was gone. And what does he see when he walks into the room? He sees this very strange, obviously unfinished image. In devastation, he decides he's going to commit suicide. He has come so close to having the darshan, the view of the Lord of the world, Jagannath himself, and now he's spoiled everything by his own impatience. But then, Jagannath, again, coming to him in a message from the sky, assures him, no, everything's all right, it's under control, this is my plan, this is my intention. I am appearing in this form for my own purposes, so be happy that I'm in this form. And then there are other stories about why he is in such a strange form, which I don't have time to go into. The other image we saw quite briefly the last time is Radharaman, and here the point of showing him is, in this case, that he is understood by the tradition to be a svayam vyakta or self-manifest. Here the story is that a particular ascetic, Gopal Bhatta Goswami, had a stone which is revered by Vaishnavas to be a form of Vishnu, Narayana, Krishna, which needs no formal installation. He was dutifully daily offering his praxis, his sadhana, his worship to this image, but was feeling some dissatisfaction. Why? Because this stone is not really conducive to the offering of all of the services which are traditionally offered to the deity, especially dressing. How do you dress a small round rock? And so in his feelings of incompleteness, the deity appears to him. One night he goes to sleep literally crying in feelings of inadequacy and incompleteness, to wake up the next morning to find that his stone, Shalagram stone, had been replaced by this quite small image. He's just about 11 inches in height. There is a whole book about this particular image, and I thought to pass it around while I continue talking, because it has quite some striking photos. Here you get an image of a picture of him in his temple with his devotees all lined up to receive him in a kind of royal reception style. I just put it at that page, but I suppose you're welcome to look at other pages as well. So that's kind of these three samples. Historically, we can say this image and this temple comes from the 16th century, about the middle of the 16th century, so fairly recent. The previous temple, Jagannath, the present construction of that temple is dated to the 12th century. The tradition says it goes back much later, but the history goes back that far. Well, that was it for my history and legend. because
of that, this image, like,
yes.
How does that relate to the Brahma?
Well, he is identified at least in the last several centuries as Krishna, Vishnu, Narayana. And I always say those in kind of one breath, because they're often considered very much the same person in a slightly different form. Jagat means the manifest world, and Nata means Lord. So he's particular name, so to say, of this particular image, Lord of the universe. Okay, so let's continue with first a little recollection. Narottam Das Thakur from 17th century. Last time I gave the whole song, and here I'm just taking one of its verses, expressing this longing. What is it that he wants in the perfection which he sees as this Murti Seva? Making a paste of fragrant sandalwood in a golden cup, I shall anoint Radha and Krishna's beautiful limbs, standing to the left of my guru, who is a female friend, a Sakhi. I will make a breeze with a chamarapusk for the Lord in his threefold bending form. So it's an intention that he has, not just a longing, but an intention. This is what he hopes to do. And my point here is that this is the sort of thing that would not just be done in some transcendent atemporal realm, but this would be the sort of thing that's done in the practice of Murti Seva in this world, as a practice for the very same sort of things that one would do in the world beyond. Before one gets to the activities of Seva, there would be some preparatory activities. One recognizes that the Lord is descending, and we talked about avatara and avatarana. One recognizes his grace, his accessibility, saulabhya, and at the same time, and there are debates about this amongst Vaishnavas, to what extent does one make effort? Is there any point in making any effort? But at least within this context of Murti Seva, we can say some effort is there. Some kind of effort to ascend, you can say. And that can take the form, or does take the form, of purifications, penances, tapas, austerity, concentrations, and meditation. These things providing a sort of crossover to principles of yoga, which is a theme that we don't have time to get into. These two categories are my own invention, conventional and transcendent, sort of sides to the practice of providing offerings or presenting to the divinity. The first one can think of in terms of hospitality. Someone is coming to your home, someone who's very much honored or respected. How do you respect that person? You show your respect in various ways. And so that becomes systematized in the practice of Murti Seva. But beyond that, there is, of course, a sense, a purpose of getting beyond the temporal world, and that I'm calling the transcendent dimension, where it's a kind of recognition that, well, on the one side, here I am offering these particular items, physical items, to the deity, but after all, where is all of this coming from? It's coming from that same Lord to whom I'm offering this. So what is this about? Why am I doing this? I'm doing this because it is pleasing to the Lord who is receiving them. It is an exchange, just as a child gives, you know, something to the father, even though the father has made it possible for the child to give to him. So the essential idea in both cases, or if you combine the two, there is an aim to all of this. Sadhana seeks to become siddha, perfection. And the siddha is that one becomes a participant in lila, in the divine pastimes of the divinity. All right, so now I just thought, oh, this is getting back to what I said last time. There are temples, there are also havelis. We didn't talk about this. A haveli in northern India is not a temple. It's a house. You don't think of God in his temple. You think of master of a grand mansion. But what is going on in either case is service that's going to begin in the early morning and go to the fairly late evening, 9 o'clock, possibly 10 o'clock, and then it's understood that the Lord continues his activities beyond that time, but for that we are not permitted. That goes on by his own arrangement. Central to all of these services are really three things, according to especially this tradition, the Radharaman tradition: dressing, food, and music. Things that are nice, things that are pleasant, things that are fun, entertainment. It's about, yes, in a sense, divine entertainment to a large extent. The picture I showed here, the idea is receiving the Lord as king in one sense, and so entertaining him. What does the king do in his darbar? He sits there to receive, you know, his subjects and to be entertained by them. All right, quickly, the 16-item offering, Shodashopachara Puja, it's usually called. These are divided essentially into three or four categories. So the first set of things that one is offering or services that one is offering, I've given here. Obviously, when someone comes to your home, you offer them a seat. And then you don't just leave them there, you speak with them some nice words. And then in India, since you've since the guest has been traveling and the feet have become dusty, you want to refresh them with some nice cooling water, because it's hot outside, on the feet. So that, and then the feet are refreshed by that. One feels generally refreshed. The next one I couldn't find a satisfying translation for. Arghya, that which is to be offered, argha, and which can consist of various items. Often it's simply water with particular substance. It might just be water mixed with milk. It can have certain seeds mixed in. Or it can be something more elaborate. And as far as I'm able to tell, from the tradition, this would be something that the person would take in the fingers and kind of sprinkle on the head, or else another person would sprinkle on the head. So this could be a kind of protective gesture by items which are considered protective. But they're also pointing to the person being honored as an honorable person. You get stories of questions arising. Who in this event should be the first one to receive the argya? And then that leads to all kinds of exciting things happening. And then one wants to freshen the mouth. And for that, there is water, often with cinnamon and some other spice, sweet spice mixed in. It is sipped achamana. After that comes another somewhat mysterious drink called madhuparka. Madhu is honey, and it's a mixture of honey with other pleasant and sweet things. And then, since one has just drunk something which is not pure water, again the mouth must be purified, and that is again done with the achamana, refreshing water. The next three items sort of fit together as well, and essentially it's about having a bath and getting dressed. Cloth, the second one, is sometimes taken in two ways, either as that which dries, you know, from drying off, you're wet, okay, you need to get dried off. But then what do you do after you're dried off? It's time to get dressed. And then the tenth one is ornaments. The eighth one, water, would be in a sort of routine bathing ceremony. What we're going to see in a few minutes is a special bathing in which everything else gets offered. And unfortunately, the person who asked last time what are the significance of the different liquids that are used in the bathing, I was all ready to explain it to her, but she didn't come today. So, what to do? But the standard group of things that would be offered in addition to water would be milk, yogurt, ghee, or clarified butter, milk, yogurt, ghee, honey, and sugar mixed in water. And the five of these together are mixed together. It becomes what's called panch amrita. And amrita means nectar. Ambrosia, pancha simply means five. Five things combined that make for ambrosia. Dressing, just to give a little example from a festival day, and this is in Vrindavan, in the Krishna Balaram Mandira, but this is not Krishna Balaram, this is Radha Shyamasundar, Radha Krishna, with two of his Sakhi friends. A rather little bit bizarre outfit they're wearing on that day, sort of a peacock feather outfit. And then just to make the point that this dress would be changed each day, but again, I ended up with a picture from a special festival day. This is called Chandan Yatra. It's a day when, in the middle of summer, when it's very hot in North India, in order for the Lord to be cooled off, they will make huge amounts, they will grind huge amounts of sandalwood into paste and then smear this over the entire body of the image. As you see here, not only the image, it looks like they've smeared it over his clothes and his crown and everything else. In other words, they've made, so to say, a dress out of sandalwood paste, which dries. And I don't like to think of how many hours it must have taken them then to remove that afterwards. So continuing with number 11, these next five are together making up essentially the worship itself. Okay, we've received the Lord, we've refreshened him, we've made him as he would like to be, presentable to his public, and now what do we do? Some offerings are made, and these are the essentials. Mind you that each one of these 16 items could be expanded almost unlimitedly. You can have items within items within items. You can have subsets of items that would be offered, such that you can spend an entire morning performing a worship ceremony. Or, inversely, it can be simplified, and there are options for particular situations. It might be that a situation calls for simply offering these five items. Unguents, flowers, incense, lamp, and how do we say in England? Eatables or edibles? Edibles, I guess. Edibles. Take, for example, lamps. One of the Vaishnava traditions, not the Chaitanya Vaishnava, but the Madhva tradition in the southwest, really go for lamps, so that when it's time to offer lamps, they'll start with one lamp on a plate. They will gesture, usually in somewhat circular motions, with the lamp, and then they'll take another lamp, and this time it'll be two lights, and they'll offer that, and then they'll put that aside, and they'll have another one, and it'll be five, and then the next one will be half a plate of lights, and then bigger and bigger and bigger the lamps go. One could say that, in fact, the lamp offering is kind of the high point in terms, especially for the public, of any worship procedure. But as I mentioned before, food, edibles, becomes also very central. After all, when you go to someone's house, they've invited you for dinner. You go sort of anticipating to eat. So they may offer you so many things, but if they don't offer you something to eat and say, well, thank you very much for coming, we hope you'll come again, you'll say, right, maybe I won't come again. And the final item, 16th item, is the offering of prayer or prayers and obeisance. I think I had this picture last time. Submission, supplication, it can be associated also with the notion I suggested before, that the whole process is meant for giving one's entire self to the Lord, giving oneself, not just so many things, but giving oneself. The idea is that one does not want to forget for what the purpose is. Oh, one thing I wanted to say. Someone might ask, why 16 items? Mm-hmm. According to some, at least one explanation is that there are 16 phases of the moon. And so there are, in the lunar calendar, 16 becomes a very important number, and things go on in India very much in terms of the movements of the moon, as much as, if not more, in relation to movements of the sun. Two samples here of what one might pray while offering something, in this case, dress, vastra, uttariya vastra, the lower and upper cloth. I offer this cloth of manifested knowledge to you, O Lord, whose effulgent lower body is covered by a cloth of attractive illusion, the word here being maya, illusion, and then continuing on that theme, I offer this upper cloth to you, O Lord, under whose shelter Mahamaya, the great, that which we experience in this world, bewilders the living beings. So there's a kind of philosophical expression or reflection that goes on in the course of offering so many items, which bring out something about the relation of the person doing the offering to the person receiving the offering. And about, sometimes, about how, in some sense, silly it all seems. Why am I offering this to you? You're already complete in yourself, poor none. And so this is kind of ridiculous. But I do it anyway, because somehow this pleases you, and because it's good for me. If I offer to you, then I am enriched, I am benefited, even if it doesn't help you. But indeed, it seems to satisfy you. Okay, now, ever so quickly, I wanted to get back to the little discussion we had at the end of last time. The question was raised by Swamiji, actually, about notions of idolatry in the negative sense. And Matthew, you made the point that in the tradition of icon veneration in the Orthodox Christian Church, the icon is not an idol in the negative sense, because one understands that the icon is pointing to the Lord beyond the icon. I may not be expressing that satisfactorily, but something to that effect, that there is a pointing beyond, that one is not remaining simply with this image, something of that sort. Well, I wanted to suggest, one might propose, and one does this hesitantly in the case of the Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition, to refer to an image as a symbol. But I thought if one takes Avery Dulles's definition of a revelatory symbol, one might get somewhere. Because I think one may need to use some sort of language of this sort in order to make bridges across from one tradition to another. He says that these revelatory symbols give participatory knowledge, which has a transforming effect. Okay, that kind of fits with the Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition. And they're not mere creations of human imagination. That also fits. Certainly, the tradition says these are not just cooked up by fertile brains fertile soft brains. No, they are revelations. They are, if not actually appearing themselves, they are created according to a direction which is considered revelatory, and so on. And this is kind of the point about not being taken to be simply an idol, is that there is a connection that's going back to, there's like an invisible string, if you like, or ray of light, or however you want to picture it, that the image that one sees is, we sometimes use the term, non-different from the original image, or the original deity, the original personality, the Svarupa. That what you and I, in going into a temple, are seeing is that image projected out, so to say, so that we can see and interact with that image. So that's one way of understanding how the tradition would say this is not idolatry in the negative sense. Okay, and I think I pretty much end with this. And here what I thought we'll do. Yeah, I think we might have enough of these. And this is essentially to illustrate this same point. We can cast these perhaps here. This is a little poem that was originally written in Tamil. Well, I'll do this. And I think it's the very last one here. Yes, the very last of these I've put up here. One of the Alvars, these are 12 poets of ancient South India from the Tamil land. And there are one or two points I want to make from this. And they're within each of the verses. All of these verses are dedicated to one particular deity of Vishnu, Narayana, who's pictured here. One is not allowed to take a photograph of this image, and so what you get are these kind of paintings. The Alvars, in all of their poetry, again and again, are addressing a particular deity in a particular temple, and there are several throughout all of their poetry, 4,000 verses of it all together. This particular series of 10 verses is all addressed to one of these images at Sri Ranga, Ranganatha, who is called again Master Ranga of Ranga. Arangam, Rangam. So on the one side, he's addressing this one particular deity, this one image. But notice what he says: ruler of all worlds, jewel of Arangam. So in one breath, he sees his lord of Ranga as ruler of all worlds. Ruler of all worlds, jewel of Arangam, these eyes, seeing him, my nectar, will never see anything else. This is how the whole thing concludes. I wasn't really going to read the whole thing, but I wanted to give you something to take with you that you can read in your leisure. I guess you say leisure, not leisure. But what's also intriguing is the point made by the author of the book from which I took this, Steve Hopkins, that he says, the person who prays this at the end, according to the legend, that he never did look at anything else than this image of Krishna, of Vishnu. For while all intelligent beings looked on, the saint entered bodily into the holy body of that great Perumal, mercifully purifying those whose minds were muddied by confusion. Thus the poem maps, in an intriguing double movement, both the way the temple image enters and ravishes the heart of the bard, and the way the bard himself enters, both in mind and body, the temple image. So there's a two-way entry going on. One is entering the other, and vice versa. Bringing just back to the point of connection. What is the ultimate connection? It is one of devotee with the Lord. Not with an illusory Lord, but with the Lord himself, the Swarupa, who is the master of the world. I think that kind of takes us through all of this, yes. So, before we shift media, I'm wondering if anyone has a question to any of that. Pretty basic listing of what a daily worship of an image would be. Something about the notion of idolatry and how it's not taken to be. Anything beyond that? Well, otherwise, we can continue with this. Now, let me see if I can. Questions? Yes. If anyone's ever tried to date that. I mean, some scholars of religion will say that worship of stones and trees is the very earliest form of worship of any kind anywhere in the world. And so they might say, you know, that can be taken all the way back to very ancient times. When would it have been documented in as a form of worship of Vishnu? I couldn't really say. I mean, you find it in Hari Bhakti Vilasa, so on, but that's a very late text, 16th century. It's referring to Puranic literature, which may go back to 6th, 7th century earliest, they usually say, of the Common Era. But I don't think you'll find anything earlier than that. Yes. Okay, so I think we can end this off. I don't know. Do we need to turn off lights? I think we need to move this way. Oh, we have to go to the phone. Unless, no, that wasn't planned very well. Okay, I think what we need to do is move ourselves. In order to better see. Okay, what are we going to see? We're going to see a little bit. You want to turn that off? All right. I guess it's all right. Yeah, that's fine. we're going to see about 6 minutes of an abhisheka, which means a formal bathing, a formal public bathing of this deity, Radharaman. They do it twice a year, once on the day which they count as the day of his self-appearance, which comes usually in May, and the other time is in sort of August, September, on what's considered the birthday of Krishna, Janmashtami. And this particular filming I did on Janmashtami Day, you'll see, I think, the fans turning. It's kind of hot there. You'll also see the pujaris, the priests. To me, rather oddly, some of them dressed in very nice dhoti, bright colored silk dhoti, and some of them in sort of sleeveless undershirt, white sleeveless undershirt, you know, and I just, this morning we were looking at it and I was thinking, this really looks wacky. But this is their mood. And I asked them, why do you wear it? Because in South India, this is strictly forbidden to wear sewn cloth. To wear sewn cloth is no question. But this is North India. And I asked the priests, why do you do this? And they said, well, you know, it is cold. But of course this was August, or maybe it was September, so it was really quite hot, so I don't know what their explanation is for that. You'll also see that it is only men priests, and that these are, well, you won't see this, but these are all hereditary priests. They claim to come in a line going back 400 and so many years to the original priestly family, and it's their standard in this temple that only descendants of this line, male descendants, and not anyone adopted into the family, can interact directly to act in this role as a priest. Let's see, what else did I want to explain before? You'll hear mainly what's going on is, in terms of what you hear, is bell ringing. And unfortunately, the bell of this temple at that time is cracked, so it's kind of an annoying sound. So I've turned the volume quite down, because otherwise you all go running out. Since that, they've replaced the bell. When I was last there, I was happy to see that they have a nice bell now. But what I thought to do to get a bit more of a sense of what this is about is, while this is going on, while you watch and make this multimedia, I want to read from a song which was written in Brajabhasha. This is the local poetic language, which is describing, in a sense, what is to be done and what goes on at this event, and which would be sung during this event. It wasn't sung while I was there videoing this, so I don't know what happened to it. However, you see one priest, he's sitting down in front of the image, and he is chanting something. You can't hear him because there's a ruckus from everything else. What he's chanting is the Rig Veda. He's chanting prayers from the very ancient scripture, and he's kind of telling others sometimes what's to be done next in the procedure. So I think that's all. Now let's see. Yes. Oh, there's a bit of a surprise at the end, which might require explanation, but I'll do that then. So this is spoken in the sense of the friends of Krishna, possibly the female friends, are speaking to other female friends of Krishna, and they address each other as Ali, which means not from the Mohammedan tradition, but it means female friend. Take pleasure through your eyes, Ali. Your wishes shall be fulfilled. Join with the Sakis. Let us be joyful with our hearts' desires fulfilled. Get dressed up. Let us go dancing. Strew flowers. Let us make their path easy. Strew well the fresh flowers, and let us enter the forest of devotion's ever-new groves. Spread the very fragrant sandal paste on the altar, and let us design an auspicious figure. Let us spread the finest bejeweled canopy above that attractive raised platform. So this is all about the preparation that would go on before. Set up beautiful banana tree pillars. Let us tie up auspicious garlands of fresh leaves. Set up the urn, and let us light lamps. Radha and Krishna have arrived. Meet them happily. Let us see the happiness of Sri Vrindavan. Ali, let the charming realm be agreeable to the rasikas, to those who, to the connoisseurs of devotional feeling. May the abhishek, this ceremony, please them. Dress them, and let them both be seated. All together, let us make their saffron tivaks, their marks on the forehead, placing their pearls of unbroken rice. Let us show them coconuts, new gold coins, and sweets. May we never tire of doing no chavari and seeing their gem-like beauty. Let us tune the instruments and sing auspicious songs. Let the notes fly and find ultimate happiness. Keeping hidden, let's make a breeze with fans, making the fountains spout high. Make the fountains spout like twisted strings of pearls. Let us make them feel very cool from the drops of water clinging to their very tender bodies. Let us offer them foods of various flavors and give them Yamuna water to drink. Place biri, that's betel, in their mouths and celebrate arati, that's the waving of lamps. Let us enjoy Ali, this auspicious day of Vaishak, on which Radha and Krishna appeared. Let us say jai, victory, and give our blessings. Let us bear on our heads that piece of cloth which we may receive. Bearing those pieces of cloth on our heads, let us dance and make the moon like hair joyous. Let us bring bliss into our hearts, matching their most tender love. In this way, let us sing the tale of Sri Radharaman's appearance and get a compassionate glance from Gunamanjari, expert in their service. Gunamanjari was one of the priests of the 19th century, possibly the author of this. Blessed Radharaman appeared today. Sri Gopal Bhakta's heart was happy. He was the founder to whom the deity is said to have appeared. All his work became fruitful. Radharaman, the clever prince of Vrindavan, is an ocean of the sweetest sentiments and a mine of virtues. When the pair, united in one form, appeared, the community of devotees was overjoyed. So it's understood that this particular image is Radha and Krishna combined. Normally you would have two separate images, but he's understood to be both combined. O friend, today our hearts became happy. We bathed Radharaman, seated on the lion throne in the five nectars. We bathed him in a stream of milk, white nectar with tawny curd. We smeared him. We trickled the sweetness of honey onto his graceful body, slick with ghee, the nectar of love. He is drenched in the sugar juice of his own love, and we found happiness. Although fair of body, wearing a dark cloth, Gaur, the golden one, appeared dark. Full of tender emotions, we decked him in beautiful ornaments and applied an auspicious mark. Each moment his lovely eyes cast a net of provocative glances. His body's fragrance is incense which spreads like smokeless radiance covering a lamp with beauty. Tasting the nectar which is the essence of his beauty and the nectar of his lips, we are not surfeited. The betel caused him to smile slightly in wonderful intoxication. offering our life breaths and performing the arati, friend, our eyes poured forth tears, gazing at him constantly, Sri Lalita and all the Sakis, their friends, found happiness. Along with Rupa Manjari, Guna Manjari offered himself again and again. So this is coming to the end of it, and what they're distributing in a rather raucous manner is this Charana Amrita. This is that all combined which has been poured over the image, the deity, that is now the ambrosia, the nectar, which will be drunk by the devotees and because it has quite a bit of honey in it, it will make them slightly intoxicated. And in this way they'll all be very joyful and jolly. So the whole ceremony goes on in this temple for about 2 hours. A lot of milk milk ablution is made for the deity. They bring in, you know, huge containers of it in preparation, along with all the other items that they offer. This is an unusual temple in that normally this ceremony on this day is performed at midnight or near midnight, but this temple, in order to offer an alternative for people, starts around midday. Okay. Okay, that's basically it. Yes? I made pretty good time, I think. I was worried that I was going to go much longer. Does anyone have a further question or comment? Or if you like, we can read through this whole...
I have a question about grit.
Yes.
You sort of tantalize us for putting that out in the beginning.
Yes.
What is the function of grace and the understanding of grace in the context of this kind of ceremony? So at the beginning, there has to be room left open in the act of praxis, of the act of performing these rituals for grace. What does that mean?
Well, maybe that's not a very good way to put it now that you sort of put it back to me, what you mean by leaving space. I think a better way of saying it is that the main thing that's happening is divine grace, and that one is simply... Well, that's why I use the word opening oneself to, or some kind of expression like that. In other words, the theology would be that grace is there, it's available, but to access it is the trick, is the challenge. And that to open oneself, to open one's heart to divine grace is the challenge. We've been focusing on Murti Seva, which in this tradition is counted as only one of several genres or sorts of practice that one does. Different lists are there. The more famous one is that there are 9 activities, beginning with Shravanam, which means hearing, which can include reading. Reading scripture, hearing from other devotees, and hearing Krishna Katha, hearing about the Lord and all that's related with the Lord. And then the sort of counterpart of that, Kirtanam. You hear something, and then what do you do that after you've heard? You emote, you praise, you glorify. And then after that, what do? You remember Smaranam. You've heard, you've chanted, glorified, then you have something, you have someone to remember. And so on. There are several. And then amongst all of those, one of them is called Archanam. This whole kind of more formal practice of offering, well, there's a sort of broader category, Archanam, which you can say includes or has central this formal practice of worship and yoga. So I would just say that the grace component, if you like, in the context of the Murti is that the Murti himself is taken as an embodiment of grace, the fact that he is there and is visible is in some sense how that would be taken. Yes?
I'm just thinking of the function of the ritual and participating in a ceremony like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that through the participation in this very sanctified ritual with, you know, different offerings, that one, by the participation, becomes open to that sense of grace or a heightened understanding of the availability of grace?
Right. Yeah, of course. The participation is a very real thing in what you just saw, the crowd sort of jostling each other, you know, to see. That is the participation. You are, you know, it's sort of the sense that you are here now. This is it. This is what you see is what you get. You are participating by being there, by, and then at the end by, you know, getting splashed by the Amrita. Let's see what else can be said. Well, you know, stepping back to the theology of avatara, that the divinity is appearing in the world. What is he doing? Why is he coming? To reestablish the principles by which one can be reconnected with him, the principles of Dharma and so on. And then the Murti is seen as a particular type of avatara with a special advantage that he stays there, he doesn't go away. The avatar comes, and before you know it, he's gone again. Hey, where did he go? The archa avatar comes, and he very kindly stays. And you might complain, yes, but he just stands there, and he doesn't talk. Well, the tradition is, of course, full of stories of reciprocations where he doesn't just stand there. Sometimes he does walk, sometimes he does talk. But for whom does he walk, and for whom or with whom does he talk? Not just anybody, but someone who has received very special direct bestowal of grace. Actually, this song and the author of this song, it is mentioned in the book from which this came, he is coming from what was at that time considered a lower class, a untouchable class, a class of people who would not have been at that time allowed into the temple to see the image. And so the story goes that this devotee, from early childhood, despite never being able to enter the temple, had such incredible devotion for him that he would sing all day long, all the time, on the riverbank about him. Until one day one of the priests came down to collect water for use in worship, and in the process was inadvertently nudged and therefore touched by this untouchable, the priest became angry, and I think he hit him with his pot that he was going to collect his water with or something to that effect. And then, you know, he had already told him, get out of the way, I need to collect my water. But when he came back to the temple, he found Ranganath, Krishna, with his forehead bleeding, and it wouldn't stop despite all the efforts of himself and all the priests. And then the answer came, the explanation came, I believe, in a dream that night, that you have disrespected one of my devotees, and therefore I am taking that which you have given to him to make a point, and will you kindly go down and get this devotee and bring him into the temple. And so he brings him into the temple, and when he sees the image, this is what he sings. And then he says, now I really don't want to see anything else for the rest of my life. And he's simply gazing with devotion at the image. So the grace is taken, especially in this context, as the Lord showing himself in his beauty. And there are other stories. There's a lot of emphasis in this particular temple on the beauty of the Lord. There's other stories of, again, Alvars, who were on a wayward path, but then they were tricked to come into the temple, and they saw the deity, and they were transfixed, and that was it. Mm-hmm.
Question not directly related to the topic about the Ramanand temple.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I've been reading, we've been discussing some about the environmental and the social changes in Vrindavan area in India, how that's affected temple worship. And I was reading the Haberman's book about how, an article about how they would use water from the from the Yamuna to wash the deity. Mm-hmm. But the Yamuna is the main river in this area. They become so polluted that they can't do that part of the ceremony anymore. Mm-hmm. I was just curious if you know anything about the history of the temple. As things have changed in northern India and in Vrindavan in particular, has the worship itself changed? Has the general culture and climate, has that affected in a significant degree?
When I asked the priest whom you saw in this video sitting quietly behind Radharaman, holding onto his base to make sure that he wouldn't get jostled. Bhute Krishna Goswami. I asked him that question in my extremely broken Hindi, and I said, "So, have there been changes in worship over time?" No, there have been no changes. And then I said, "Yes, but." Now we have younger generation, they are, going to university, the younger Goswamis, the priests now, they're going to the university, and now I'm seeing some of the priest families, or I am hearing television is going in the house. And first he said no change, and then he said yes, so much change.
I mean
the top, yeah. The very short instruction manual, which is used by the priests now in this temple, is from the late 19th, early 20th century. And I suspect that it was written because the leading priest at that time was feeling that things are, the tradition is kind of getting lost, that we need to get a standard here, and therefore he wrote out a procedure, what is to be done. Prior to him, it was taught father to son, and of course, the book Hari Bhakti Vilasa was there as well. but things were getting perhaps more lax, more relaxed, whatever it was. So, yeah, definitely change is happening. And you see it in the, as I mentioned, television is coming in and different elements are there. Electric lights are there now. There weren't electric lights previously. They do, speaking of Yamuna water, they told me that they still use Yamuna water, and they're quite proud of this, that they keep to that standard, but that they filter it. They collect it upstream from Vrindavan. They have to go because a lot of the drainage from the town comes in from Vrindavan, so they go upstream and they collect there and then they filter it. They're also very proud of being keeping to a standard that they say other temples don't keep, that they have the same fire in their kitchen that was there at the founding of the temple 460 years ago. Of course, one doesn't really know, but at least the claim is there that the fire that they bring in to light the lamp from the kitchen every morning is essentially the same fire. This is a Vedic thing, that you know, you keep the fires. You've heard of keeping the home fires burning. Well, that's Vedic tradition, and the claim is that we still have that fire. Another claim is that they keep a higher standard of priestly purity than other temples, and this I noticed. It's actually true that the priests will be very careful in this particular temple to not be touched by any of the visitors to the temple while they're doing their priestly services. So when they give you some tulasi leaf prasad from the deity, they'll be very kind of careful that you don't sort of inadvertently touch them with your hand. They'll sort of, you know, drop in your hand. Whereas you go to some of the other temples, they're not worried about that in the same way. But then on the other side, they have a daily schedule in the Radharaman temple, which is quite a bit different from at least the Radhagopinath temple around the corner. Radharaman temple, the first worship of the day is about 5 o'clock in the morning. The next worship of the day is around 9 o'clock in the morning. And when you ask them why this long gap between 5 and 9, the answer is because it takes that long to dress Radharaman. It takes that long to... Yes, it takes that long because sometimes he refuses to accept the ornaments you give him. And then you go around the corner to the Radhagopinath temple, where they have... Also in Radharaman, the times are really quite flexible. You know, you can be sort of saying, well, so isn't it time for the aarti now?
Yes, it's coming.
You ask them around the corner of the Radhagopinath temple, so what's happening there at the Radharaman temple? Ah! They're doing all crazy things there. You know, so there's these little sort of inside different perspectives amongst the temples of how things should or should not be done. There is a logic of why you don't have strict timings in the Radharaman temple, related to what I said. Sometimes Krishna doesn't accept, because it's the bhava, it's the mood that we do things in his own sweet time, not in our time, in his time. When he is ready, then something will happen. If he's not ready, then it's for us to be patient.
Yeah. On the other hand, there are very strict rules about what you describe in your book, what he eats. Mm. You don't ask him what he wants to eat and give him the...
Yes. Yeah, so there's kind of two sides. Yes.
In your talk, you mentioned that the offering is made to please the Lord, and there are three kinds of offering, and in these things, I can sort of understand why he's pleasing to the Lord. But I'm just curious, in what way sort of this avishes, like pouring of like a I mean,
what's so pleasant about getting honey poured all over you?
Yeah. I'm just curious if there's any sort of, I don't know, rationale behind it.
Well, that's kind of tied back to the question that actually Gabi, who's not here today, was asking about what is the meaning of these items. Mm-hmm. I think one general meaning of two things, the Abhishek. First of all, it's an echo of the consecration of kings. What do you do when you consecrate a king? You do that sort of thing. Why do you do it with all of these liquids? Well, you're bringing the best of everything. You're bringing the best of everything to that king. You're bringing also the worst. I mean, there are descriptions of what you do at a deity consecration where you have everyone imaginable present. You have the celestials, but you also have the demons there. You have, you know, you have everything and everyone. You have all the elements. You have, yeah, everything there. And so here the principle, that I would say, is totality. You are making an arena in which the king is in the center of everything and everyone. And you're sort of demonstrating that. The other principle is, and this really goes back to at least Upanishads, if not Veda, the idea of essences. So milk is, you know, reworked grass. And it's kind of, it's grass and it's vegetation worked into its most perfect form by that most amazing animal, the cow. You take that essence and you make it more of an essence. You get, you know, yogurt, and even more so you get clarified butter and so on. An essence of an essence. What is honey? It's an essence of that which has been collected from flowers, which are considered most auspicious. Done, you know, as we know how honey is made. And then that, again, is brought into play as a kind of essence. So the essence of things and the totality of things all participate in this recognition ceremony that this person is now the one that we say he is.
I was interested by your comments on the deity sometimes coming to life. Because that is a parallel with Eastern Christian images as well.
Right.
And I think it centers in the common belief of both traditions that you do have a physical object that in most instances is man-made, but that is not simply a reminder of divine things, but in fact a direct point of encounter with the divine in a certain way. And there are all sorts of stories of icons that work miracles.
Right.
And one of the most famous is a man who is praying before an icon, and he's praying and the icon answers back. I think one of the most singularly interesting is on Mount Athos, there's the icon that's, you can see, I always call it the icon of the angry baby Jesus. And he looks very angry. It's a traditional icon of the Mother of God holding Christ in one arm. And in the normal icon, he's sitting quite peaceably giving a sign of the blessing. I showed a couple of these and she's pointing towards him. Everyone looks rather somber and peaceful. In this one, she is holding his wrists quite strongly and he is looking very angry and she's looking straight ahead. And the story is that the monastery was being attacked by heaven only knows who at that point. It was always being attacked. It sits right on the coast. And the monk monks were not very good monks. They had all become quite lax, etc. And the attackers had been invading for weeks, and they had simply barricaded themselves in, but there was a great silence for several days, and I thought, all the attackers have left, we can go outside and get our food, etc. And the Theotokos, the Mother of Gods, decides to warn them, no, they're just hiding, waiting for you to open the gate, and they'll fled in. So the icon, which is on the outside of the building, it's painted on the exterior of the temple, comes to life in the seeing of all of the community. The Mother of God starts to speak, and Christ gets very upset. He covers her mouth and says they have not behaved well, and I wish them to be warned. And she forcibly grabs his wrist, lowers it down, and says, they're hiding outside. You do not deserve this warning. Now pay attention to my son. And the icon freezes then in that form, where it still fans that way. That's the story behind it. But it's interesting that in both of these very different traditions, you have the idea that this meeting place of the divine and the material, the divine and the human, of the icon or the image, is usually static, but not always. Yeah. Precisely because it's a meeting place of the divine, occasionally the divinity bursts in unexpected ways.
There are probably any number of such, maybe not quite like this, but there is, I showed Jagannath, there is a story which is from 16th century of Jagannath appearing with his brother Balaram on horseback in order to defend their king from in one of his battles. There's a whole story about how he realizes that his lords from the temple have now come out of the temple in order to help him out in the battlefield. So yeah. Things
in relation to the Orthodox icons, there are similar traditions going up around icon worship, that particular devotion to this icon as being particularly powerful, because of the stories that are attached to them, and that gain fame and following over and above other icons, like in our tradition.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the icons that are meant to be usually called wonder-working icons. Sometimes did miraculous icons. Yes, they will have traditions gathering around them. Certain icons are known for prayers offered before them for specific things. We come to those certain icons where prayers are offered before for the healing of cancer, or there were some that are for fertility, for example. When couples can't spare children, and they'll pray before certain icons, and it becomes known for that. And then you have certain icons that are known as protectors as well. There's a whole branch of the Eastern Church that's dedicated to one icon, which is named after the tree under which this icon was miraculously found. It had been lost, stolen, and presumed gone forever. It was found beneath a certain tree, and it bears the name of that tree now as an icon of Christ and his mother again. But it's understood to be a great protector. Yes, certain of the specific images will take on the devoted following.
Any comments from either of our swamis? Very quiet during our whole series.
That's a little question.
Yeah.
Like when you were referring to South India, of the greater and greater lamps, offering up the lamps.
Yeah.
What is the idea behind that? Is it gradually revealing the deity through the light, the flame that more and more is gradually revealed, or is it why so much?
I never heard their explanation. I suppose that could be one. I think there's a certain amount of dramatic effect as part of it. they say there that the ideal flame for viewing the image is burning camphor. They say it's the purest light. And unfortunately, camphor makes a lot of smoke and a lot of ashes all over. But it is, yeah, it is. I mean, the effect is certainly dramatic. You're sort of, you're really kind of awed by the show of lights. And I think certainly that's one element of it. It is awe-inspiring to feel something significant is happening here. Yeah.
Odd side of grace.
Yes.
Traditionally had it that, first of all, the grace of the deity that he's there. He's chosen, as it were, to show up. And then in relation to what you said about opening oneself by sadhana, that there's a sort of opportunity for grace. One serves the deity, one follows the procedures or participates in the activities, and by one's mood of devotion, one hopes that one will receive the grace of the deity in that context.
Good. Well, I guess we come to a rather good closing of our series and section and series. And I want to first offer my thanks to Matthew for your enthusiastic and illuminating participation in this. And thank all of you for coming today and those other sessions that we had. I feel personally I feel in a sense that we just scratched the surface, but you've got to start somewhere. And let us see. We have something of an idea to develop something like a book out of this, but that we have to discuss.
Let's see how it goes. Something will come.
Something will come. Something should come out of it.
Perfection.
Yes.
It's a high request for someone. Thank you for organizing this.
Thank you so much.
For the idea to pull it together.
So. Thank you so much. So you have to rush off now, otherwise we could...
Sorry?
Do you have to rush
off
now?
Yeah, I'm afraid.
Oh, you can do it. Okay.
But we'll be in touch.
Yes,
And we'll talk a little bit about the way forward.
We will. Okay.
That'd be good. I mean, if you're up for that, it'd be good to...
Yeah. It is.
Going from one thing directly to the next. Thank you very much. We'll speak to you. Sorry.
Okay, Matt. Okay, I won't keep you. Goodbye. And thank you for coming. It's been wonderful. Very good. You've graced us all with your presence.
My name is Elsa.